Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome along to the programme. Justin Brierley here for Unbelievable. Between now and 4 o'clock, I'm going to be joined by people with different perspectives. That's what we do every week here on the show that, as I often say, aims to get you thinking, and a really interesting discussion on a recent fossil discovery in South Africa. I'll give you the full details in a moment's time. Of course, we'll hear some of your feedback later on in the programme. We aired a documentary on some of the debates that go on down at Hyde Park between Muslims and Christians. That's got quite some interesting response, because you would have heard a lot of yelling if you were tuning into the programme at this time last week or you listened via the podcast. A little later on after that, there's The Profile. Sam Hales will be speaking to Nihad Salman, pastor of Emmanuel Church in Bethlehem. He set up the only Christian bookshop in the West Bank. Going to be talking about being a Christian pastor in that, obviously, that area full of turmoil in the Middle East. So look out for that between 4 and 5 today. If you want more about Unbelievable, though, and the vast archive of past programmes, all the debates we have between Christians and non-believers of various kinds, then why not go to the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and find out more about it there, how you can subscribe to the podcast, read the articles, the blog, and so on. I got my websites confused, I realised, last week. I mentioned the magazine website instead of the radio show website. They're quite similar, so it's easier to do, because premierchristianity.com if you want to read the magazine that I edit. But yes, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable for the show and all the things connected with it. So let's get into today's programme. You're unbelievable. Well, today on the programme, we're talking about Homo Naledi and the Adam and Eve debate. Earlier this month, headlines around the world reported one of the most significant hominin or human ancestor fossil discoveries in history. Paleontologist Lee Berger led a team of scientists who found numerous fossil remains of a new species, Homo Naledi, in a remote South African cave, possibly used as a place of burial by the species in the distant past. Well, some claim the discovery could have massive implications for our understanding of human evolution. But what about the implications for Christian faith and the biblical account of how we came to be? So what is the significance of Homo Naledi? We're going to be looking at that today on the programme. How does it sit alongside the evidence of other ancient hominid ancestors such as Homo erectus and the Neanderthals? Can Christians who believe in the fossil record also believe God had a plan for these other species? What makes our species, humans, Homo sapiens, unique? And how do we square this all off with the story of Adam and Eve in Scripture? Well, to help us think through these issues, I'm joined today on the programme by Fazal Rana, or better known as Fuzz, really. Fuzz is Vice President of the Science and Faith Research Organisation Reasons to Believe. He's the author as well with Hugh Ross of Who Was Adam? It's just been republished with a 10-year update. And Fuzz takes what's sometimes called an old earth creation view. He doesn't believe, as in common with young earth creationists, that the earth is relatively young. He does believe it's hundreds of thousands of years old, but believes that biochemistry, genetics, and the fossil record do nevertheless support a biblical case for the special creation of Adam and Eve by God as the first humans who populated the planet. You want to find out more about Fuzz and the team, reasons.org, and you can find some of the resources they've already released around this interesting new fossil discovery. James, or Jim Kidder, holds a PhD in biological anthropology. He's recently written about Homo naledi for the Biologos Forum. Jim takes a theistic evolutionary view. That's the view generally taken by Biologos in the US. He believes that God has used a process of evolution to create humans. He's quite excited about this new discovery and runs the blog Science and Religion, A View from an Evolutionary Creationist. scienceandcreation.blogspot.co.uk, or maybe it's different in the US, but in any case, that will get you there. James and Fazal, or Jim and Fuzz, welcome along to the program.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Great to have you both on the program today. Perhaps just at the outset, it would be helpful, before we start talking about this new discovery, just to very briefly both spell out your stance on evolution and creation. So Fuzz, just briefly, you're an old Earth creationist. What does that mean exactly? And what does it mean when you come to talking about issues like Homo naledi?
Yeah, well, Justin, as you alluded in your brief introduction, we take the position that the Earth is 4.5 billion years in age, that life probably was present on the Earth for the past 3.8 billion years, that the fossil record is a sampling of life's history. So we have no dispute with that, the scientific data that's coming from planetary science and geology and paleontology in that respect. And we would square that the antiquity of the Earth and the antiquity of life on Earth with the Genesis 1 creation account by noting that day in Genesis 1 refers to a period of time as opposed to 24 hours or a calendar day. In that respect, we're able to harmonize the Genesis 1 account with the scientific record, where we would look at the different days of creation as being snapshots or highlights of God's creative work that are organized more or less in a chronological order. We are creationists, meaning that we believe that God intervened throughout Earth's history and life's history to bring about his creative purposes, and this would include the origin of life and major innovations in life's history, including the origin of humanity. And so as part of that, we are skeptical of aspects of the evolutionary paradigm, namely relating to the origin of life and what one might call macroevolution, though we're completely comfortable with the idea of microevolution and speciation. So that's kind of our view in a nutshell.
Yeah, really helpful nutshell too. And obviously we'll get a bit more detail from you about how you see these various evolutionary finds as they seem to be in that context. Jim, thanks also for being with me today on the program. Great to have you for the first time on the show, but I was drawn to getting in touch with you having seen you already writing about this new find. Just briefly though, you call yourself both I think a theistic evolutionist and an evolutionary creationist. What do the terms mean?
I don't think actually we can figure out which one is more accurate. There are some people that think theistic evolutionist is better because it describes a viewpoint that believes that evolution is guided by God. Mm. And there are some people that argue that evolutionary creationist is better because we are creationists in that, as Fuzz points out, we believe that God is guided, directed, and is the sovereign ruler of the universe.
Indeed.
So either one really works,
as far as
I'm concerned. That's why I put them both in my title of my blog.
I think probably sometimes those who prefer theistic evolutionist perhaps feel the word creationist has so much baggage attached with a particular view that they prefer to avoid
true.
It. But
that's certainly true.
I mean, and it's fair to say that if you like, the voice that isn't here with us at this point is the Young Earth Creation view. And I'm just going to say at this point, for those who listen to the show and are Young Earth creationists, this is not a slight. It's just that there are sometimes conversations that you simply can't take in too many directions. And so I just felt that having a Young Earth creationist perspective as well would take us down an almost entirely different conversation. But you are a an evolutionary creationist, a theistic evolutionist. So you believe then, Jim, that you know as far as you can see, the evolutionary story, as told by the, you know, the majority of scientists, is true and is the way God has acted in his creation.
Yes, that's exactly what I believe. It's interesting because I was listening to Fuzz describe his viewpoint, and I agree with everything he said, all the way up until the point where he decided not to go down the evolutionary path. Mm. I think that the fossil record, and the paleontological record in general supports an evolutionary perspective. It supports common descent. It supports an overall trend in an evolutionary fashion. And I think it's even modern genetics, if you read the work of people like Jerry Coyne, if you read the work of Levine, it seems that there is just a whopping amount of evidence for an evolutionary perspective.
Well, obviously, we'll get to, I'm sure, debating that in the course of the program. Before we do that, we need to talk about this new find, Homo naledi. So what do you make of all this, Jim? Is it as significant as many of the headlines seem to have suggested in the last month or so?
It is, and I'll tell you why. Mm-hmm. It is the first, if we are to, and I haven't actually held the skull or anything like that, but so I'm going on published descriptions. Mm. But if the published descriptions are in fact exactly accurate, then it's the first unequivocal early Homo find in South Africa. And not just a find, a huge find. Mm. Because up until this point, and even Fred Grein has pointed this out a couple of years ago, we've never really had a smoking gun for early Homo in South Africa. We've had little pieces here and there that we thought might be early Homo and maybe not. This is big. It's huge. Mm. This is early Homo in South Africa. Not just early Homo, but early Homo with some very advanced traits.
And tell us about some of those traits. Why do they believe it could even be that there were, in a sense, religious
when Lee Berger and his team started pulling the material out of the ground, they noticed a couple of things that were characteristic not of any Australopithecus that has ever been found in the area. For one thing, they found a couple of traits that are found pretty much only in Homo erectus. There's something called an angular torus, which is almost a de facto characteristic for Homo erectus. If you put your finger right behind your left ear, and then you kind of draw a line to the back of the head,
I'm doing it right now. Yeah.
Okay. There is a ridge of bone that extends from behind the ear to the back of the head. It's called an angular torus.
Yes.
It is only present in Homo erectus.
Now, what's significant about you're using some terms here, Homo erectus, Australopithecus, I can't quite pronounce it, but what's the significance of this particular species being found in Africa, in South Africa?
Well, the significance is that it's very advanced, for mm-hmm. one thing. It differs markedly from anything else we're finding in the area. So we don't know if it migrated in. We don't know if it originated there. We have very little information along those lines. One of the things that is striking about it is it bears a very striking resemblance to a find in the site of Damanisi, which is 1.8 million years old, which is in Russian Georgia. Mm. It has lots of the same characteristics. So there's got to be some rethink in terms of how large a range or what sort of model fits this pan-African pan-African geographical distance. It's got other characteristics that are not found in any Australopithecus. It has a ridge of bone on the top of the skull. It's called sagittal keeling that you only find in Homo erectus. The brow ridge right above the eyes is much more expanded. It's like as in Homo erectus. And yet, at the same time, it has some very primitive traits. It's got a very small brain. Mm. The fingers are curved. The hip joint looks Australopithecine and very early Homo. But then again, the wrist and the hands and the legs, the wrist and the hands and the feet rather, look more human.
Yeah.
The feet especially have muscle markings and bone articulations that give you the impression that this thing was built for running.
That's interesting.
Which is not something you find. any Australopithecus.
We'll get on to the implications of this for how it fits into the fossil and evolutionary record as regards to Homo sapiens. But let's get Fuzz's view on this as well. Fuzz, what's your reaction overall to this discovery? And do you think it's as significant as obviously Jim does?
From my perspective, I think that this represents one of those beautiful examples of how serendipity plays such an important role in science. When you read about the process of discovery, it was an incredible enterprise in terms of excavating and cataloging and analyzing the fossils. So to me, this is an example of science at its very best. I think it is a significant find in the sense that it's probably the largest hominin find in Africa, if I'm not mistaken, and very well may be the largest hominin find ever once the site is completely excavated, because there's over 1,500 fossil specimens that represent 15 individuals. And so in terms of the magnitude of the find, it's clearly incredibly significant. Again, it's a beautiful story of how science works. And it's also, I think, remarkable in that you have, in many instances, multiple versions of each bone that allow you to get a very good understanding of the biological variability of Homo naledi. And plus you have juvenile individuals, you have adults, you have male, female, so you can get an idea of sexual dimorphism, about the process of growth and development. Again, you understand biological variability. So this is just, in a sense, unheard of to have that kind of data all from a single site. Now, in terms of whether or not this may potentially be a transitional form linking the Australopithecines with the Homo genus, I think it still remains to be seen.
Just walk us through that before you go into that, Fuzz, because I think for some people who may be lagging behind a bit here, the question is, what's the issue at stake here? Is the excitement around the fact that possibly this could be what's, commonly called the missing link, that there's some way in which we're lacking these, as you say, transitional forms that would potentially give us a sort of an evolutionary story from very early kind of, ape-like creatures or whatever it is into humans, and that if Homo naledi potentially gives us something along those lines, and so we can see a sort of a very, the evolution of from one thing to humans. But go on. Is that why people are excited about Homo naledi?
Well, I think that would be one reason why people would have excitement about this, is that it very well may be documenting, I think, as Jim alluded to, from an evolutionary perspective, that point of transition or that window of transition, giving rise to the genus that we are part of, namely the Homo genus. But one of the big question marks right now is the age of Homo naledi, because the researchers were not able to date the site that these specimens were found in. And this is not negligence on their part by any means. These specimens were not buried. They basically were sitting on top of the cave floor. And so there really is not a way to date those specimens, at least readily. And so Jim is making an assumption that these actually are at about, somewhere between 2 and 3 million years in age at the time where you would expect that transition.
I didn't make that assumption. What I said was that the morphology is similar to that's found. You are absolutely correct about the cave floor issues, and I was going to speak to that in just a minute, but go on. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So, but anyway, because it very well could be, if this is a more recent specimen, then it could actually be something similar to the hobbit, the Homo floresiensis, if people remember, that was discovered a few years ago now on the island of Flores, which was in the range of 12,000 years in age, which was similar to Homo naledi in that it was a small-brained creature that had kind of a blending of Australopithecine and erectine-type features, if I'm not mistaken, people would probably argue it represents some kind of evolutionary side branch or dead end. So it's not really clear, where to actually fit Homo naledi in, because we don't have the date for that specimen. Now let's say for the case of argument, sake of argument, that this actually is this essentially at that window of time, in the 2 to 3 million year window of time. The question still becomes, is this actually the transitional form? because Lee Berger and his team discovered Australopithecus sediba, that they at one point were alluding to the fact that this might be that transitional form. And if that was the case, it would have displaced Homo habilis and Australopithecus afarensis as the transitional forms. Other people have argued, like Tim White, that maybe it's Australopithecus gari that's that transitional form, because this creature seems to have been making use of tools based on butchery marks associated with remains, faunal remains found with gari. Other people have claimed Kenyanthropus platyops would be that transitional form. So you have this jumble of specimens that have been assigned to different species that are all at one point in time claimed to be these transitional forms. And to me, it appears to be more confusion as opposed to more clarity about how this would have happened.
So as we get a multiplicity of these discoveries, as far as you can see, we're not getting any clear story coming out about sort of a path of evolution from one thing to another. You're merely finding lots of different examples, but nothing that necessarily equates to this so-called transitional form. Let's bring in Jim then. Yeah,
this?
Go ahead.
Yeah, can I speak to this? Okay. Okay, we need to get away from this notion of a transitional form. We need to get away from this notion of a missing link. There is no such thing. In the last 30 years, paleontology has undergone almost a paradigm shift towards a systematics way of doing things. So what we're, instead of looking for forms that do things, you know, that look a certain way, we're looking for traits. And what we're doing is analyzing how traits change. And once you start analyzing how traits change, then you see where certain traits are more advanced than others in certain forms, and where they're less advanced than others in certain other forms, and things like that. And then what you begin to do is you begin to draw taxonomic trees based on these trait polarities, based on these trait characteristics. And Fuzz is right. We don't know where early Homo came from. We don't. That's one of the really serious issues, partly because there have been so few specimens of early Homo that have been found, and they've all been found in East Africa up until this point. But if you start focusing on the characteristics themselves, then you start to see this particular form, and Homo naledi has a constellation of traits, enough of which are similar, or enough of which are unique to it, that you call it a different species, because you have to. You have to name it something.
Sure.
But what you do is you analyze what the traits look like and what other forms these traits are similar to and what other forms they're different from. If you read Berger et al.'s paper, there's a long list. Okay, here are the traits that it shares with Australopithecus afarensis. Here are the traits it doesn't share. Here are the traits it shares with Australopithecus sediba. Here are the traits it doesn't share, and so on. And so you begin to draw a picture of not people, not species that are moving forward in time, but traits that are moving forward in time. Now let me talk a little bit about the cave problems. South African caves have been a tremendous nightmare for paleontologists working in South Africa since Raymond Dart started discovering the Australopithecines in the 1920s, primarily because what happens is they are all limestone, and as water percolates through the surface of the surface of the ground, it creates these huge limestone caverns. Well, eventually enough water percolates that the ground opens up because it can't support the weight anymore, and so you have this open cave. We can date the cave floor. We can date the cave walls. We can't date what's dropped in.
Yeah.
It's like Fuzz says, it's not for lack of trying, and it's not because they're not being diligent. They are. We just don't know.
Sure.
We have Zippo idea how old these things are.
Can we make the assumption that they seem to be drawing the conclusion that it was some kind of burial ritual that was happening whenever these bones were dropped into the cave? It was because they had some view of some kind of religious instinct, let's say.
I'm gonna have to go with Bill Jungers on this one. Bill Jungers came to the conclusion. I think he's right, but I'm not positive that that's not what it was. If you've got somebody who's died, you don't want him lying around. You want to do something with him. You want to get rid of him. Oh, look, there's a cave. Poof. Drop them in.
Yeah.
I think it may very well have been nothing more than that.
Okay.
I don't know. I can't say for sure. There's the criticism of that particular viewpoint is, why are there only hominins in the cave? Why are there no other animals in the cave? Because that's a striking peculiarity.
But you don't feel the evidence quite warrants getting to the conclusion that it was a burial site. I don't think so, no. Let's bring Fuzz back in at this point. Fuzz, the major part of what Jim had to say there was that he feels you're barking up the wrong tree by talking about transitional forms anymore. It's about traits going forward in the evolutionary history. What's your reaction to that?
My particular view of the hominids being an old Earth creationist would be that these were creatures that existed for a period of time and then later on went extinct, that they were created by God. I would allow for, obviously, microevolution and speciation among the hominids, but I would argue that there was, again, instances where God is intervening to bring about his creative purposes. And the fact that you see creatures that display a mosaic of properties, again, could be interpreted, I think, reasonably from an evolutionary framework, that you are indeed seeing kind of a transition happening over time in different species with regards to the trait projections, as Jim is describing. But from my perspective as an old Earth creationist, I would just look at those mosaic of traits as reflecting, again, design. It's not uncommon for designers to take a mosaic of properties and produce a single design from it. You know, for example, a smartphone represents a mosaic design where you have, you know, a cell phone and you have an MP3 player and an internet device and a camera, all at one point in time were separate pieces of electronics that are now, you know, introduced into a single design as a mosaic. So that's how I would interpret them. And when it comes to the topic of burial, I think Jim and I are in agreement with this. In a sense, I think it's fair to say that nobody really knows how those hominin remains actually wound up in that particular site. As Jim points out, it doesn't look like these creatures were living there or that they were occupying the cave, but because you don't see faunal remains, you don't see any kind of archaeological artifacts that would indicate that they were occupying those sites. There doesn't look like there's any butchery on these bones, so there's no cannibalism, or they weren't consumed by predators or brought into the cave by predators. But to claim that this was a burial seems to be, to me, far-fetched, because when you look at the cave topography, you have this 45-degree incline into an open cavern, but then there's this thing called Superman's Crawl, which is a 3-foot-wide tunnel that you'd have to carry remains through in the dark into another open area. You'd have to scale this limestone slab that's almost a sheer, you know, would be a sheer scale, to then drop, you know, these remains into a very small opening, all in the dark. That seems to be rather far-fetched.
Yeah, and indeed, the researchers themselves had to get through some pretty tight spaces in order to discover this cave and its fossil remains in the first place. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with more from my two guests, Jim and Fuzz. We're debating today Homo naledi, a new discovery recently in South Africa. And what does it do in terms of playing into the whole Adam and Eve debate, creation, evolution, so on? That's what we're discussing on Unbelievable today. Hope you're keeping up with this, because we're using some fairly technical scientific terms. But we'll try and make sure that we keep it at a level where everyone can take part. So do keep listening. We'll be back in just a moment's time with my guests today on the programme, Fuzz Rana and Jim Kidder.
It's not unusual to be loved by anyone.
The date was October 1965. The trousers were flared, the skirts were mini, and an unusual magazine was about to launch. Buzz connected young Christians to contemporary culture and music. Well, 50 years on, and today called Premier Christianity, this month we're celebrating half a century of connecting faith, church, and culture. Why not read the story for yourself and request a free copy of our beautiful golden 50-year anniversary edition by visiting premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the programme that aims to get you thinking every Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio, Unbelievable. And if you're listening later on, you'll be able to hear some feedback to recent weeks of programming. Had an interesting documentary aired last week, Up the Ladder in Hyde Park. Completely different to what we're doing today on the show. But I was talking about some of the interactions that go on there between Muslims and Christians. And we'll see what you thought of that, because there was a lot of yelling on last week's programme. So we'll come to some of that a bit later on in the show. Today, though, Homo Naledi and the Adam and Eve debate. That's what we're talking about. As earlier in the month, headlines around the world reported one of the most significant fossil discoveries in history. Lee Berger led a team of scientists who found numerous fossil remains of a new species, Homo Naledi, in a remote South African cave. So some claim it could have massive implications for our understanding of human evolution. What about the implications for Christian faith, though, and the biblical account of how we came to be? Well, so far, Fuzz Rana and Jim Kidder, who join me on the programme today, have put their different perspectives across as to what the significance of this find is. Fuzz is an old Earth creationist. He's part of the Reasons to Believe team. And in his recently republished book, Who Was Adam, he makes the case for the fact that a special creation of Adam and Eve by God is supported, in fact, by biochemistry, genetics and the fossil record. Jim Kidder, on the other hand, is what you might call an evolutionary creationist or a theistic evolutionist, holds a PhD in biological anthropology, writes for the Biologos Forum, and he's been looking into Homo Naledi, and he believes it supports the general evolutionary view that humans are the result of a long process of evolution. One, yes, that God had a hand in, that God meant to be used for the creation of eventually of humans, but which obviously took things in many different directions in the past. So this is fascinating stuff, gentlemen, and thanks for being with me on the programme today. Because for me, I suppose the big question that arises, for instance, in your view, Fuzz, that Homo Naledi is another instance of a hominid discovery, but that these don't necessarily all, you know, tie into an evolutionary story of human beings, which you believe obviously sort of run separate to that. And the natural question that arises is, well, these human-like creatures that were running around, possibly burying their dead, maybe we don't know, but what can you imagine God's purpose was in kind of creating all these different, if you like, genuses and species and so on within that?
I mean, in a sense, that question is really part of a larger question, which would be, why did God create any kind of creature on planet Earth? And that, in a sense, we can ask that question, whether it's referring to hominins or the great apes or the different types of cats, for example, that we see. So I would argue that, again, these are part of God's creation. And I would assume that they obviously played some kind of important ecological role in the environment that they lived in. My co-author of the book, Who Was Adam, Hugh Ross, has suggested that maybe these creatures played a role in preparing other creatures for the advent of humanity, because it's really interesting that when humans began to migrate around the world, as they made their way into Australia or into the Americas, they triggered mass extinction events. But yet we didn't see mass extinctions, or at least the loss of animals in Europe and in Asia and in Africa, where these hominins had their distribution prior to the advent of humanity. So maybe they played a role in that particular sense. Or maybe God created them for just simply sheer enjoyment. I like to think of God as an architect, where God is creating things for a purpose, but also there's an artistic flair to what God does as creator. And just as an architect is interested in designing things for function, but also for form and for artistic value, why couldn't God do the same thing? So in a sense, I don't really know, I guess, why God created the hominins, but I think that their existence doesn't necessarily create any kind of real issue for a creationist position.
But your view would be that it was only Adam and Eve, or Homo sapiens in that sense, that God actually imbued with a spirit. Would that be so that whatever these other hominins were and doing and being, they didn't have, in that sense, the image of God in them in the way that you would speak of to the Adam and Eve couple?
That's exactly right. We would argue that it was only modern humans that we would argue are descendants of Adam and Eve that possess the image of God. These other creatures had intelligence. They had emotional capability. They were remarkable creatures in their own right. But I would not. I would argue that they lacked the image of God or the Imago Dei, and that property exists exclusively with modern humans. And it's interesting to me that there is, in my opinion, mounting evidence for this concept of human exceptionalism, that we do really seem to stand apart from all other creatures that exist today on Earth, but even from other creatures that have existed in the past, like the hominids. And so I think there's a scientific undergirding to the idea that humans are exceptional in the way that we would understand the image of God.
Okay. We'll talk about that more in a minute, but let's bring Jim back in here. So, Jim, as a theistic evolutionist, you obviously believe that, if you like, humans are the end result of a long process of evolution, and you wouldn't see that them as having been specially created at a point in history by God in that sense, in the way that obviously Fuzz sees it. But what's your view then on what these other forms and early hominids and so on? Do you believe they could have had a kind of a spiritual awareness, or God, you know, or were they in effect, you know, like any other animal, if you like, in that sense? And do you think that humans, even though you believe they arose differently to how Fuzz does, still are kind of distinct and unique in that sense?
Well, as the whole idea of this of the spiritual awareness of humans is really once again another $64,000 question, because in the fossil record, as far back as Homo erectus and China, you have clear concrete evidence for controlled use of fire. You have stone tool use in East Africa and places in South Africa as far back as 2 million years. And this is stone tool use that is very, very different from anything practiced by chimpanzees or any other species on the planet. It is specific modification of natural resources to provide a function, to serve a function. Mm. Now whether that in and of itself, you know, indicates any spirituality, I'm not sure. But it does indicate increasing cognitive awareness
and intelligence, I suppose.
And intelligence, yeah. Exactly. Now, at some point, they became aware enough to understand the notions of death, afterlife, you have grave goods, mm-hmm. Burials, things of this nature. Now, whether God reached in at that point and said, "Here I am," I don't know. It's hard to know exactly where that occurred, and there are different, of course, there are different perspectives on that. Davis Young, when he was at Calvin College in Michigan, really tackled this, and he came up with no really good biblical models in terms of how we ought to view this information. I would ask one thing though, point out, when we look at the fossil record, one of the things we see is that 99% of all species that have ever lived on the planet have gone extinct. Mm. And to those of us that posit an evolutionary perspective, that seems awfully wasteful.
Sure.
In terms of a special creation perspective, it seems like God's throwing away a lot of things.
Starting things and then throwing them away, kind of thing.
Yeah, making them and then throwing them away.
Yeah.
If on the other hand, God is overseeing, God is timeless. God, there's no beginning to God, there is no ending to God. So if God, in his, as Fuzz put it, in his joy, in his, you know, desire to create life and see life, to me, it makes just as much sense for him to create it and use an evolutionary process to guide it and make it go where he wants it to go, eventually yeah. ending up with us. To me, that makes more sense than specific creation where he's throwing away so many things.
I mean, I'd like to come first of all, answer to Jim there, but also to talk about why you do believe there's a scientific case for special creation. But yeah, first of all, this objection that Jim has, it seems wasteful, the special creation model, because projects get started and then finish, whereas seeing it as a big evolutionary story kind of maybe seems a little bit neater and more aesthetically pleasing to Jim in terms of God's purposes.
Well, you know, the thing that I would point out is that the history, that throughout the history of the Earth, the conditions of the Earth have changed. And so organisms that could live at one era in Earth's history would not be suitable to live in other times in Earth's history. And so if you have a creator who takes joy in creating, and there's value in organisms as, you know, in and of themselves, in the creator's mind, then why wouldn't the creator create things, let them exist for a period of time, and then they disappear and they're replaced with new creatures? And many creatures that have existed for, you know, vast periods of time before they went extinct. It wasn't like they were created, they went extinct, they were created, they went extinct. There was, again, you know, these creatures existed for a vast period of time. And so I don't necessarily see that as wasteful, but maybe as a reflection of the fact that God enjoys creating, and as the conditions of the earth change, organisms are just simply by necessity are going to go extinct. I mean, an analogy that I would use, maybe a silly analogy, but an analogy I would use relates to my wife. My wife loves to do interior decorating, and she's constantly decorating and redecorating her house, changing the color of paint or the wallpaper in a room and the furniture and the wall hangings. And then a couple of years later, she goes back and redoes rooms. It doesn't mean that my wife's activity is wasteful, but rather it's a reflection of the fact that she's creative and she gets tremendous amount of joy in doing those types of things, and then is recreating and renewing things out of her compulsion to create, not because what was done before was somehow substandard. It's just that she wants to do something new. And why couldn't we look at the history of life in those terms and not as a wasteful God?
Do you want to come back on that, Jim, before we talk about the science as well?
Yeah, sure. Okay, I guess I understand that perspective in a sense that, sure, God could do that. And in fact, because we don't know the mind of God, we don't know for sure that, you know, how he would do this. The thing that I always come back to is that the vast majority of paleontologists see these small changes, and they see the same kinds of changes occurring in species today. And they see, like, for example, ring species where you have the salamander out in the West Coast, where they exist around a fairly large rock promontory, and all of the species on one side can interbreed with each other, and you get to the end, and the last species cannot interbreed with the first one, and that's how speciation occurs.
Mm.
And you have other instances of that kind of thing occurring. So you do have evidence of speciation occurring. And as Ernst Mayr said in the early 1940s, you know, when he came up with the biological species concept, that is the concept that we use in biology today, is are they reproductively isolated? If they are not reproductively isolated, if they are reproductively isolated, they are de facto different species. Now, one of the things that is commonly lacking in discussions about evolution is the role that genetic drift plays. Genetic drift plays a huge role in evolutionary processes. Typically, evolution is always thought of as being selection. Well, what happens in two species that have been separated, or two species that are reproductively isolated, is their gene frequencies of various traits start to drift. And Kenneth Miller had a really good example of this, where there was and I don't remember the name of the fish, but there was a fairly small fish that lived in a fast-moving environment, and they picked some of the fish up and moved them to a very slow-moving environment with very few predators. And then they came back 10 years later, and the other fish were much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
There were other traits. The traits had started to change. They had started to deviate. And it wasn't because there had been a speciation event. It's because the two populations had been separated and began to drift away from
David,
each other.
Sure.
I see that happening a lot in the fossil record.
And so for you, this all kind of amounts to evidence, along with Homan and Eddie and all the other finds, that, well, simply reaffirming that humans have evolved and they share a common ancestor in that sense with modern apes and so on. Let's talk about some of this science, Buzz, because I think that's where we've got to. You obviously disagree fundamentally with Jim's point of view in terms of the evolutionary record and what it tells us. What I'd like us to get to this point, though, talking about Adam and Eve, the first human couple and so on. Jim just sees, you know, all kinds of evidence all over the place that this is a big kind of evolutionary story in which humans are the sort of the end product and you've got different branches and so on. You don't see it that way. What scientifically makes you resist the idea that the evolutionary story, tells us everything?
Well, I came to faith in Christ because I saw insufficiencies in the evolutionary framework. I was an agnostic when I started graduate school, and what dislodged me from my position of ambivalence was essentially two things: the amazing design of biochemical systems, but coupled with the fact that evolutionary explanations for the origin of life were completely deficient in my mind and still remain deficient today, 30 years later, from the point that I came to that conviction. And that was, to me, eye-opening because I was under the assumption as an undergraduate student embracing the evolutionary paradigm that evolution could explain so many things that we see throughout the history of life. And the fact that it couldn't account for the origin of life, to me, suggests that this is not an all-sufficient explanation. And this was instrumental in me coming to faith in Christ. And then, now as a Christian, looking back at the scientific data and being convinced that Scripture seems to be teaching that God does indeed intervene at critical points in the history of life in a direct personal way to bring about his creative purposes, the question then becomes, how do you make sense of the scientific record where people like Jim look at it and say, well, this is evidence for evolution? So it's kind of a top-down approach. And from my perspective, when you take that top-down approach, there's nothing that's been discovered that indicates that a creationist perspective is invalid. So, for example, as I mentioned already, when you look at the hominin fossil record, you can easily make sense of these creatures from the standpoint that these were creatures that God created that existed and then later went extinct. Now, granted, I don't dispute anything that Jim says about evidence for speciation. I think there is evidence for speciation. In fact, I would even allow for evolutionary processes to happen at the level of a genus or even at a family level. But I do think there are places in the history of life where you see where there's got to be divine intervention when it comes to introducing novel designs, if you will. And so, for example, we've been discussing about the fact that nobody knows where the Homo genus comes from. Could this be a place where God intervened? Or we don't know how to account for human exceptionalism. Could this be, again, where God intervened? So I think there are places even within the human evolutionary story where there are these significant gaps where new discoveries don't seem to be bringing clarity in my mind, but seem to be creating greater chaos. Could this be signatures for where God would have intervened? Or if you talk about the genetic similarity between humans and the great apes, or even humans and Neanderthals and the Denisovans, since we have genomes for these two hominins, you could look at those similar features as reflecting not common descent, but common design, that a creator's employing similar design features to bring about his creative purposes. So to me, it's not a bottom-up question, it's a top-down question.
Just briefly before we come back to Jim, where and when do you believe that Homo sapiens, humans, first came from? Lots of evolutionists say there was a kind of a group population that humans kind of evolved from, whereas you, I guess, say no, there was a definite first female, first male. So where and when were they?
I don't think you can get information about when humanity was created from the biblical text. I think it's silent on that. But so I would use the scientific dating methods. But I think there's good evidence that modern humans appear somewhere between 100 and 150,000 years ago. And I would argue that there was a de novo creation event where there was a primordial pair. And, you know, this becomes a very messy technical discussion. But I would argue that there was, there is evidence for a primordial pair that is revealed to us through the concepts of mitochondrial Eve and Y chromosome Adam. And the claims that there was a population, I think, are unsubstantiated, scientifically speaking, that the different modeling that's done to argue for a population, not a primordial pair, from genetic variability, in my mind, are methodologies that actually don't, that are, have not been validated, that demonstrably fail.
Yeah, okay. Well, Jim, I mean, I did want to try and get us to this point of talking about Adam and Eve, and obviously Fuzz takes the view that there was a creation event to create the first two, human couple in that sense. What's your take on this? Do you believe that it was a kind of, just that continuing gradation and humans at some point, if you like, that there was a point at which Homo sapien arrived on the scene, though not no individual couple that we can kind of trace that back to, as it were?
Well, I'd like to get to that, but I want to go back just a minute to something Fuzz said that struck me rather forcefully.
Yes.
Where he said that there has been evolution at the genus level and even at the family level. Okay, if there's evidence for speciation, how would you tell the difference when there wasn't? It all looks like evolution to us. And in fact, then how much evolution would be permitted? How would we ever know when God actually intervened in a non-evolutionary way if it all looks like evolution? And then the secondary, what happens if we do discover the smoking gun? You know, those are, I think, serious questions.
Do you want to answer them quickly, Fuzz, and we'll come back to Jim?
Well, I think one way we would note when that we see that God's intervention is when we see discontinuities. And so, for example, I think when modern humans appear on the scene, what you're seeing in terms of behavior is radically different than what you see with respect to the other hominins. There is a sharp demarcation between the behavior of modern humans and anything that precedes it. That would be a point of discontinuity. I think when it comes to the appearance of the Homo genus, that to me looks like a discontinuity. So those would be places where I would argue that God is intervening in the context of human evolution.
And it can't simply be explained by speciation and evolutionary methods in that sense.
I don't think so.
Mm. Does that satisfy you?
Can I respond to that, please?
Go ahead.
Okay. Modern humans appear between 160 and 190,000 years in northeast Africa at two sites. One is the site of Herto at Buri in the Afar Triangle and near the Middle Awash, and the other is the site of Omo Kibish. And they're fairly securely dated, so Fuzz is absolutely correct. That's when modern humans appear. The catch is modern human tools don't appear until about 150,000 years later. You don't get modern behavior out of these early moderns. You get nothing like that. And we have another real peculiar issue going on in the Mount Carmel Cave. The Mount Carmel Caves were excavated in the late 1920s by Dorothy Garrod and T. Dale Stewart. And it was a salvage project, so they had to strip the entire area. And they found a couple of very striking things. They found modern humans, and they found Neanderthals, and they found that were not dated quite to the same time period, but they were using exactly the same tools.
Right.
So the problem then is you're asking yourself, okay, were the Neanderthals smart enough to use the modern tools, or were the moderns not smart enough that they had to use Neanderthal tools? Or do those tools basically reflect a similar, if not identical, cognitive pattern?
Yeah.
So there's not a one-to-one correlation between when the modern human morphology appears and when the modern tools appear. And secondarily, I would add that when you have the earliest modern humans in Europe, dated to between 34 and 37,000 years ago, around the Mladic cave site, in between the two glacials in that interglacial period, they're using a kind of cursory or Ignatian stone tool type, which is different from the kind that the Neanderthals were using.
Just give us the big picture here, then, Jim, because I'm worried
picture,
about
the big. Okay, I'm sorry. The big picture is that changes in tool type don't necessarily follow cognitive changes. They follow changes in population density, the need to build a better mousetrap, the idea, the need to build, to bounce things off people. You see modern tool types changing rapidly as population density increases. You don't see that happening in between 150 and 200,000 years,
okay,
because you don't have the population density.
So, as I understand it, and forgive me if I've got this wrong, Jim, but Fuzz, I think what Jim is saying is, when you look at the way the modern humans were acting in their early stage, They don't seem to have the same kind of functionality and cognitive awareness and so on going on that kind of develops with the use of tools and everything. So it's hard to kind of make this strict kind of time at which humans kind of, you know, in with their God-given capacities suddenly came into being. I think that's what Jim's saying.
In a nutshell.
Okay, good. I more or less got that.
Yeah, and I'll just simply, you know, point out that And I document this in the update to Who Was Adam, is that there's mounting data that indicates that evidence for symbolism, which I take to be the closest archaeological signature for the image of God, evidence for symbolism is actually moving to an earlier and earlier date. And so there actually is evidence, again, for, I think, symbolism approaching the time where we think anatomically modern humans appear on the scene. And to argue, it's very difficult to assign who used what with in terms of tool use from cave sites, because you're essentially correlating the discovery of a fossil specimen with the discovery of an archaeological artifact. But you have all kinds of things that complicate that when you have multiple occupations of cave sites and the possibility that there was intermixing of those cave layers.
Yeah,
and so
but you don't have that in this case. They were very, very carefully excavated, and when they were dated by thermoluminescence and electron spin resonance, they were dated to 100,000. Both the layers that had the stone tools and the layers with the hominids.
Well, I don't specifically have information about that particular cave site, so you know I'll just have to take Jim's word for it. But when I look at the archaeological record comprehensively, I don't see that kind of a correlation that Jim is pointing out to. And in my experience, the claims that Neanderthals were engaged in symbolism or were behaving in an advanced cognitive way are generally highly suspect and are highly speculative conclusions that aren't affirmed, in my mind, by the data at hand.
Okay. We're going to have to take a quick break and come back in a moment's time. We're talking quite an advanced level conversation about human origins and some of these ancient hominin forms of you know, pre-human species and so on, especially in light of the recent discovery of Homo naledi. What does it tell us about our past, what it is to be a human today, and what the Bible and the biblical view of Adam and Eve have to say about it? Perhaps we'll get some final thoughts on that as well from both my guests today on the programme in a moment's time. Fuzz Rana from Reasons to Believe, and James Kidder, biological anthropologist and who runs the blog Science and Religion, A View from an Evolutionary Creationist. Do come again in just a moment's time as we finish today's show. Welcome back to the final part of Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. And don't forget that if you want to get in touch with the show, you can do that by emailing unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Be interested to hear your thoughts on this discovery of the Homo naledi fossils over in South Africa. And certainly, as I've said earlier, we haven't included a young Earth creation perspective on today's programme. Please don't send me too many angry emails if you're annoyed about that. But do feel free to add your perspective if you are coming from that point of view and what you make of those kinds of discoveries of various types of hominids and so on. Because I will be happy to read those out as well. Just didn't feel that it would make sense, you know, in this particular conversation to do that, which would obviously take us into all those areas of whether we can, you know, trust the carbon dating and all the rest of it that would inevitably emerge. But we will be hearing some of your feedback to last week's programme towards the end of today's show. If you're not aware of it, there's also something interesting you might want to look at, the Premier Christianity blog. That's the magazine I edit. And we've responded to a recent survey put out by the Evangelical Alliance here in the UK, which suggests that up to 40% of people in the UK aren't sure about the existence of Jesus or even actively disbelieve in his existence, think that he's fictional. Now, that seems like a huge number, 40%, but that is what the survey appears to say. Well, we've responded to that on the blog, saying 40% of people doubt Jesus existed. Here's how to change their mind. It's a blog by a young apologist called Steve Cooper on some of the things that you could say to someone if they were really grilling you down in the pub about the evidence for the existence of Jesus. So worth checking that out at premierchristianity.com/ blog. While you're there, you can check out some of the anniversary stuff going on. 50 years old, the magazine, and you can read some of the history there. See a video that I've put up in the last week giving a little whistle-stop tour through the 50 years of the magazine and some of the colourful covers we've had in that time. For now, let's get back into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, it's been at times technical, but certainly a very interesting discussion today between my two guests. They take different views on the origins of humanity. Fuzz Rana, who's a vice president of the Science and Faith Research Organization out in the States, Reasons to Believe, is the author with Hugh Ross of Who Was Adam? It's recently been republished, a 10-year update to that book. But putting the case for the idea that Adam and Eve were a special creation of God, and that there are certain issues with the evolutionary record that make it difficult to see how humans were simply, you know, a product along with everything else of evolution. And so we've been talking about Homo naledi today, a recent discovery of a new, what appears to be a new species in South Africa of the hominin genus. I've learned all kinds of new scientific terms in the course of looking at this week. But Jim Kidder, theistic evolutionist, has been talking about why he believes it's just another indicator that God did use a big picture evolutionary process for the creation of humans.
I want to respond to something that Fuzz said just at the tail end, just before we went to the break.
Go ahead,
I do that
Jim.
Real quick?
Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. Fuzz was casting some disparaging light on the abilities of Neanderthals. There are three specific stone tool technologies that you find in Europe that are at the early modern human Neanderthal boundary. One is called the Ulusian in central Italy. One is called the Siletian in central Europe. And one is called the Chatelperronian, which you find in France. I've done more reading on the Chatelperronian and the Siletian than I have the Ulusian. But one of the things you find in the Chatelperronian that is really interesting is, based on the stratigraphic understanding of the sites in which it is found, Neanderthals are, in fact, creating this thing. Okay? The catch is, it's got blades, backed blades, it's got sharper knives, it has much more advanced characteristics than you find in earlier Neanderthal sites. Now, there are all kinds of different hypotheses about why this is the case. Are they interacting with the modern humans? Are they responding to pressure? Are they responding to population pressure from the modern humans? Are they just evolving themselves? Who knows? What you do know is they become significantly more advanced.
Hmm.
And that's true in these three different areas. It's true with the Siletian, it's true with the Ulusian, it's true with the Chatelperronian. So I think, and one of the things that Randall White said, Randall White was a gentleman who wrote a good deal in the 1980s and 1990s about Neanderthal and early modern symbolic behavior. And Randall White was very specific in quite a few of his articles that there is no sharp demarcation line.
Okay.
That you see gradual increases in symbolic behavior in Neanderthals, and then lo and behold, you have continued increases in symbolic behavior in modern humans. And we even see this as an offshoot of what I was saying just a minute ago, where you have modern humans once about 30,000 years before the present up to the present, taking off. I mean, really taking off.
Yeah.
Taking off in terms of culture
and
things like that.
In the end, and I'll you know, if I were to ask you, okay, well, what's God doing in all of that then?
I think God is raising up people that he can commune with, that he can interact with, that he can reach down and say, I am here, I am your creator, I want you to know who I am.
And in that whole evolutionary process, there's a sense in which eventually creatures come to a position where they're able to reach towards God in that sense.
Yes.
They come to some kind of consciousness of God, which for you, would that be the point at which, I don't know, you would say, I don't know how you take the Adam and Eve story yourself, Jim, but do you see it as a kind of a representative story? Do you believe there were a first couple that kind of were given kind of an actual consciousness of God? What's your take on that?
Yeah, good question. I think a couple things. I'm perfectly open to the concept of there being a real Adam and a real Eve, but I think based on what I understand of the fossil record and what I understand of genetics is they are recent. They are Neolithic farmers. For one thing, if you read the story in Genesis, which is very highly stylized, incredibly highly stylized, if you read the story in Genesis, they go directly from being in the garden to farming. They don't go through hunter and gathering stage. They don't at all. They go directly to farming.
Indeed.
That to me indicates a Neolithic perspective. I think the garden story is written in such a way as to be readable to the people of the day. I mean, because if you look at the way the rest of the creation story is written, and if you look at the way the universe is viewed. I mean, you have the hard dome above. You have the encircling sea. The sun, Earth is flat. You know, if you look at all that, it makes perfect sense that the Adam and Eve story is written in that kind of context.
Yeah. Okay.
Once again, I'm open to the idea of there being a real Adam and Eve, but I think they're Neolithic.
Okay. Okay, Fuzz, time as we start to wrap things up for your kind of take on all of this. Firstly, if you want to respond to Jim's view there that there isn't this sharp demarcation as far as he's concerned, that Neanderthals were coming to points where they were using things quite intelligently, perhaps even alongside modern humans and so on. I don't know whether you do believe it goes back to the kind of Neolithic man and so on, the Genesis story, but be interested in your take on all that.
Sure thing. Well, with regard to the Chatelperronian culture, we would have to be very careful about concluding that Neanderthals actually possessed advanced cognitive ability and even the capacity for symbolism, because as I cite this study in the book Who Was Adam in the update, is that there have been studies done where people have gone in and very carefully carbon-14 dated layers where you have all these different artifacts and the hominin remains and modern human remains. And what they've shown is that you don't see a nice smooth transition as you go through the layers, but things are jumbled up in terms of the carbon-14 dates, which indicates that there's probably mixing in those cave layers and that the Chatelperronian may not have been an authentic culture, let alone, again, evidence that Neanderthals had a capacity for symbolism. So I don't think, you know, ascribing symbolic behavior to Neanderthals is a straightforward enterprise from the archaeological record. And again, when I've looked at studies where people have claimed symbolic behavior, I find the case very non-compelling, to be quite frank. And we actually have discovered cave art in sites in Southeast Asia now that are of the same quality in character as the cave art in Europe, produced again by modern humans, and dating at about 35 to 40,000 years in age. So it looks as if humans had this capacity for symbolism before they even left Africa and began to migrate around the world. And again, you see other archaeological evidence that pushes back that behavior closer and closer to the time when modern humans appear. My view in terms of was Adam Neolithic or Paleolithic, I would take the view that he was Paleolithic, that what we see in Genesis 1 is the creation of Adam and Eve, that coincides with the appearance of anatomically and behaviorally modern humans, and that I would argue that the Genesis 1 text is not referring to a Neolithic time window, but actually, again, a Paleolithic time window. And we're seeing evidence that farming and proto-farming practices are going back closer and closer again, away from the Neolithic, at least moving away from the Neolithic time frame, to a much earlier time frame, suggesting that humans very very well may have had an understanding of agricultural practices closer to their time of origin.
And so what I'm getting from this in that sense is that you do believe that, you know, that the modern humans were, you know, came on the scene with farming capabilities, as it were, because that's obviously what Adam and Eve were given. Their task, as it were, in the garden was one of tending and cultivating.
Right. And there would be a difference between large-scale implementation of agricultural practices versus localized usage, which wouldn't leave behind any kind of archaeological record.
We probably don't have time, I'm afraid, to continue the debate on that front. It's opened up a whole interesting area of the nature of Adam and Eve and the different perspectives you both take on that. But we'll have to leave it there. And if people want to find out more, I'm sure they can follow things up at reasons.org. That's where Fuzz blogs and does podcasts and releases new resources. And you can find out more about his republished book with Hugh Ross, Who Was Adam? Reasons.org. Jim Kidder, who's been our theistic evolutionist on the show today, blogs at Science and Creation. .blogspot.co.uk or to give it its full title, the blog is Science and Religion, A View from an Evolutionary Creationist, if you want to look up Jim Kidder. Gentlemen, both, thanks for being with me on the programme today. It's been really great having your interactions.
Well, thank you so much for having
pleasure.
Us.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, once again, if you want to get in touch about anything you've heard on the programme today, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Be interested to hear your thoughts, wherever you stand on the evolution-creation debate, and we'll look forward to reading some of those out next week on the programme. You can also, of course, find us on Twitter and Facebook, facebook.com/unbelievablejb, if you want to look at the things I'm posting there and perhaps comment on them. And also the Twitter is @unbelievablejb to follow me there and see what's going on as well. So we'll read out some of your comments via Twitter and Facebook, as well as some of the emails in a moment's time. Just sending out greetings, though, today to everyone attending the Reboot conference, specifically aimed at young Christians and put on by the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics, happening today in London. So they're expecting over 900 young people at that, which is just fantastic. So such a great initiative, and lots of people from the OCCA will be putting the case for Christ and helping young people with their questions about Christianity there. But if it's not too late to book in for some other things, such as the Clarkson Academy coming back to London next week. It's a pro-life training and equipping event. It's run by Greg Cunningham and Scott Klusendorf. Scott, of course, came on the programme to debate abortion last week. If you want more about that, clarksonacademy.org. That's clarksonacademy.org. I've also been sent information about, relating to last week's programme a little bit, a Christian response to the challenge of Islam. It's a two-day teaching conference on November the 6th and 7th, and it features Asif Mal, David Pawson, and Jay Smith, who, of course, was one of the people in last week's documentary that I aired. It's taking place at Mulberry House, which is in High Ongar, Essex. If you want more information, mulberry-house.com, or look it up on the internet, a Christian response to the challenge of Islam at Mulberry House. And it's going to feature a lot of seminars and, as I say, some pretty well-known names there as well, David Pawson and Jay Smith, both taking part. Okay, so there's just a few of the things to look out for if you've got room in your diary. Let's look at some of your feedback to recent editions of the programme. Last week on the show, I read out in the feedback section the story of Jeremy Behrman, a Jewish man who lost his faith because of suffering. And this is what Suzanne in East London emailed in to say, I would want to say to Jeremy, the Jewish man, that suffering doesn't mean there really is no God. Trying to be more religious in the hope that God will answer you and then rejecting him when he doesn't seems to be somewhat unreasonable. Why should we blame God when things go wrong? God cares for us deeply, and this is the gospel message, that Jesus was sent from heaven to be crucified for our sins and rise for our justification. God has shown his mercy throughout Holy Scriptures. Sorry for your difficult situation, but I know God is merciful from my personal experiences of the promises of God. May you find his peace, says Suzanne. Well, a lot of you were also commenting on the show itself, where we did this documentary, re-aired a documentary from 2008, Up the Ladder in Hyde Park, where I went down there and recorded some of what happens each Sunday afternoon as Christians and Muslims get together to debate certain aspects of faith. And it's a very rowdy affair, as you will have heard. There were questions for me about whether this is Christ-like behaviour. Jay Smith, the lead evangelist there of the Hyde Park Christian Fellowship, said, well, a lot of Europeans don't get it, but actually for many Christians in the Middle East, Eastern culture. This is really important, actually. Here's some of what you had to say on Twitter. Gregory Piper said, J. Smith is such a brave man. Smiley face. Saints and Skeptics tweeted, good to hear that free speech is alive and very, very loud in London. Steve tweeted to say, just listened, enjoyed the documentary very much. Reminded me of the label New Atheist, but from theists. New theists? Most of all, it makes me regret not living in London to attend. And Ian Johnson said, just been listening to the unbelievable show on Speaker's Corner. It has nothing on Twitter. Aaron Hughes says, I'm unconvinced by the shouting of Jesus, we love Jesus, and so on. It doesn't seem like the Christianity of the Bible. I understand it's culturally more applicable in the East. What are your thoughts? So I got back to Aaron on that and said, yeah, I was torn by the fact that both the Christians and the atheists kind of got up to chanting and so on, at each other. But I said to Aaron in my tweet, but God does use many things as a means of his grace, and Muslims have come to Christ through the activities down there at Speaker's Corner, to which Aaron replied, that's true. And they did say that their goal was not your normal Muslim. Thanks for the show. Always enjoy it. Thanks for tweeting me, Aaron. Meanwhile, underneath that show from last week, if you go to the page on the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, Kirkatori says, what an emotional mess. Pathetic. While you're all down there ranting and screaming at each other, I think I'll head to the hospice with my Muslim friends and actually help some people. Meanwhile, Peter O'Brien says, combining the themes of the last two shows, it would be good to have a show on what Christians and Muslims actually agree on and promote how the two groups can live together more peacefully. Both agree there is a creator God who chose a small part of the Middle East to communicate directly with humans. There's a significant overlap on recognizing prophets like Adam, Abraham, Noah, Moses. Both agree Jesus was special and in supernatural aspects of his life. It's whether he was special or really, really were special worth fighting over. Both believe in heaven and prayer. You go on to list other similarities between Christianity and Islam. J. Smith, you say, is a formidable apologist. I've learned a lot about Islam, especially its origins and history, from watching some of his YouTube speeches and debates. Yet he would be entirely unsuitable to participate in a show aimed at fostering better relations between Christians and Muslims. It took a long time for Protestants and Catholics to reconcile, but it got done. Let's hope Christians and Muslims can do the same before they might destroy the world. Well, I mean, I'd take issue with the idea that Christians are, in a sense, destroying the world. I think they're obviously debating. I don't think Christians pose a threat in terms of, you know, actual lives lost specifically in the world today. But nonetheless, you obviously feel that that we need to tread a different path of mutuality and understanding. And absolutely, there's, in a sense, is there room for both, I suppose, is the question. And J. Smith's brand of, you know, that quite high-octane debate with Muslims who are at the more radical end of the spectrum. That was some of your thoughts underneath that show. By email, Marie got in touch to say, J. Smith is one of the most knowledgeable evangelical Christians, well qualified to speak about the Islamic faith. He's been preaching the gospel to Muslims at Hyde Park for a number of years now. Many will not agree with his methods, but as Jay said himself, Muslims don't listen to weak, woolly-minded Christians who they have no respect for, but they will listen to Christians who know their faith as well as the Islamic faith and can quote from both with confidence. Long may Jay reign in Hyde Park. If nothing else, he may make his mark with the Muslims who have been given the truth about their faith as well as Christianity more than they ever have before. And Ed says, first off, good work on the unbelievable programmes. I've been listening to you since you were with John and Maria on The Breakfast Show many, many years ago. Well, that is a long time, Ed. I enjoyed listening to the Hyde Park special. I used to frequent Speaker's Corner myself, coming back from church, Kensington Temple in Notting Hill, a number of years ago. I usually listened to the Christian-Muslim debates as well as the general political debates. I even once found myself shouting from the crowd to express my disagreement with what someone had said. This was after I had promised myself not to. I guess you just get swept up in the moment, don't you, Ed? Anyway, you say, I haven't been to the old place for a few years now, but your programme brought back many memories for me. Cheers and stay blessed, bruv, says Ed. Thank you very much, Ed. So just a few there of the comments that came in regard to that programme. Thanks also to those who've been in touch about another documentary that came out a few weeks ago now, the one on my grandfather's time as a prisoner of war in the Far East. Lainey in Kuala Lumpur emailed to say, no, not emailed, sorry, Facebooked me to say, good day, Justin. I do not know where to begin, but I have to simply thank you for putting together this amazing weekly program, Unbelievable. I should have written in a long time ago, as I've been faithfully following your program via podcast for 3 years now and have gone to the archive time and again to listen to programs that interested me. I feel like I've taken you and your program for granted, not writing in all this while. Unbelievable has been one of the very few things that have been so constant in my life these past few years, as my reasonably stable existence working in ministry in Australia had been interrupted in 2013 by a sudden move to New Zealand and then Canada and then to the US and all over Europe for a summer, then back to the US and, since almost 3 months ago, quite unexpectedly, back to Malaysia, where I'm originally from. Thank you for airing such high-quality discussions. I've attended many talks and debates that are supposedly of the highest quality, but quite frankly, not many highly acclaimed once-off events come even close to the quality of discussion I get to listen to on a weekly basis on Unbelievable. Man, do I feel spoiled. What a lovely message, Lainey. I really made my day when you emailed that in, so thank you very much. But on the programme that I was referring to there about my grandfather, you had this to say, the recent programme on your grandfather Jeff Mowat struck a chord in me, as I've recently been in Malaysia and Singapore. Plus, being Australian, there was that connection too with your grandfather and grandmother's story. Having listened to that made me feel like I had to write in to thank you for all these years of programming, and thank you in advance for many, many more episodes to come. Thanks for getting in touch, Lainey. It was lovely to receive that. Tim in Kobe, Japan says, thanks for posting the story of your grandfather and his experience during World War II. It was reminiscent of the recent Unbroken book and movie. I think you'd be very interested in another such story that's now out under the title of Wounded Tiger. It's a gripping account of how two former enemies were brought together as servants of Christ promoting peace and reconciliation. Mitsu Fuchida was the lead pilot of the Pearl Harbor attack and was well known in Japan as one of their war heroes. Jake DeShaza was a bombardier on one of the bombers in the Doolittle raid that was in response to the Pearl Harbor attack. He was captured by the Japanese and had to endure 3.5 years in the hell of prison. There, however, God worked in his heart, just as he did with your grandfather, to transform hate into love. And after the war, Jake went back to Japan as an evangelist to seek reconciliation through forgiveness. Together with a third strand of the story, which involved a missionary family by the name of Koval, God brought all this together with the conversion of Fuchida to Christianity and his joining the team to bring Christ to his own people. The author, Martin Bennett, has done a masterful job weaving the story together, and I've headed up the team to put out the Japanese translation. It's now being translated into Chinese. Anyway, please take a look at the website, woundedtigerbook.com. Martin is trying to come up with investors to make this into a blockbuster movie where the message isn't truncated as it was in Chariots of Fire and Unbroken. That sounds really interesting, Tim, and I will look into that, because an amazing story to tell of two people on both sides of that conflict working together to preach the message of Christ now. That's woundedtigerbook.com if you'd like to find out more. Okay, well, I think that's about all we've time for this afternoon in terms of your feedback. Thank you for getting in touch, and we'll see if we can get to some more of your feedback next week on the programme at the same time. What's coming up then? Let me tell you right now. You're unbelievable. Next week on the show, we're doing the subject of Mormonism. We're going to be meeting a Mormon, and we're also going to be meeting Bill McKeever, who has a ministry to Mormons, and they're going to be debating the whole area of grace and Mormonism. So look out for that next week. Church of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Church, is what we're going to be debating. Hope you can join me for that at the same time as usual and online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. For the moment, I'll leave you in the capable hands of Sam Hales here with The Profile.